This meeting of the Commonwealth Club is called to order. I am Julian Chang, your moderator for this evening. It is our pleasure and honor to welcome to our podium Dr. Jose Zuniga. Dr. Zuniga was appointed President and Chief Executive Officer of the International Association of Physicians in AIDS Care in December 1999. Prior to his appointment, he served as IAPAC's Vice President for Programming, charged with advancing the Association's international portfolio of medical education and technical assistance initiatives. Immediately before joining IAPAC, Dr. Zuniga served as Director of Communications at the AIDS Action Council in Washington, D.C. from 1995 to 1997. Having joined the United States' premier AIDS advocacy organization after 4 years of service in the U.S. Army. While he was in the Army, he had tours of duty in Operations Desert Shield and also Operation Desert Storm. Since his appointment, the association's membership has grown to more than 13,000 members in over 100 countries, and its geographic reach has expanded to include a headquarters office in Chicago, Illinois, an African regional office in Johannesburg, South Africa, and a public policy office in Washington, D.C. Also, since December 1999, IAPAC has hosted 27 national, regional, and international conferences ranging in focus from clinical management to public policy, of which Dr. Zuniga has chaired 8. The association launched its peer review clinical journal, JIAPAC. In 2001, which is edited by Dr. Zuniga and indexed in the National Library of Medicine's Index Medicus. And since 2003, IAPAC has coordinated the Global AIDS Learning and Evaluation Network, GALEN, program, through which thousands of HIV/AIDS treating physicians in the developing world have been trained in HIV clinical management and subsequently written the world's first proctored certification examination in HIV medicine, many earning a certificate of clinical competence in HIV medicine. Dr. Zuniga's lectures at various academic institutions have been published in numerous journals, authored thematic chapters in several books, and he has also served as contributing editor for numerous books, including The HIV Pandemic, Local and Global Implications, published by Oxford University Press in 2006, and A Decade of Heart, The Development and Global Impact of Highly Active Antiretroviral Therapy, also published by Oxford University Press in October 2008. Dr. Zuniga serves on a number of advisory bodies, including the IAPAC Board of Trustees, the Humanitas Foundation Board of Directors, the JIAPAC Editorial Advisory Board, and the Secure the Future Technical Advisory Board. I'm also honored to serve with him on the Service Members Legal Defense Network Board of Governors. Dr. Zuniga is a technical consultant for various public policy institutes, including the Jonathan Mann Health Human Rights Institute. He also routinely advises intergovernmental agencies such as the Pan American Health Organization, the World Health Organization, and the Joint United Nations Program on HIV/AIDS. On today, as we commemorate and celebrate the work of physicians treating AIDS around the world, it is our distinct pleasure and honor to welcome such a distinguished speaker. Welcome, Jose.
Thank you very much. I don't usually get such long introductions, but thank you. Very generous one at that. I'd like to thank Julian Chang and the LGBT member-led forum for this kind invitation for me to address the Commonwealth Club of California, which also allowed me the rare privilege of visiting a city that was witness to some truly transformative years in my life. I'm honored to be here with you this evening to commemorate the 21st annual World AIDS Day, a solemn annual commemoration steeped in remembrance but pointing toward action. I imagine that some of you are familiar with the Eastern African nation of Uganda, a country about the size of Arizona, situated to the west of Kenya and on the northern end of Lake Victoria. If so, it's quite possible that this comes through stories and images of Uganda's descent into military dictatorship throughout the 1970s under Idi Amin, the infamous military general who was recently depicted on the big screen by Forrest Whitaker in The Last King of Scotland. My own formal introduction to Uganda came over 12 years ago. The memories of that experience are not conjured as images of war or political strife, but rather a series of images and emotions anchored around the meek figure of a man whom I came to know simply as Thomas. The truth of the matter is that I did not actually know Thomas, nor would I ever get the chance to know him. The reason is that my introduction to Thomas, and at the same time to Uganda and to sub-Saharan Africa in general, came on the occasion of his funeral. The year was 1997, and I was setting foot on African soil for the first time. Earlier that year, I'd been hired as deputy director of a relatively new nonprofit organization formed in Chicago called the International Association of Physicians in AIDS Care, or IAPAC, a group which I have gone on to head. Back then, while I was already somewhat long in the tooth on some important domestic activism, such as our own domestic struggle against AIDS in San Francisco and later in Washington, D.C., I was admittedly greener to the complex struggles for health, dignity, and human rights outside our borders. I'd been drawn to IAPAC and to Chicago from our nation's capital, where I'd served a 3-year stint with AIDS Action, as Julian mentioned, a domestic AIDS policy group some of you may also know. Well, no sooner had I settled my belongings to my new Chicago home than I found myself boarding a plane for Uganda. I was headed there at the invitation of the Joint United Nations Program on AIDS, otherwise known as UNAIDS, to examine the possibility of introducing life-saving and enhancing antiretroviral drugs into Africa for the first time ever. A mere year since the advent of antiretroviral therapy was heralded in the United States, and against conventional wisdom which argued, for example, that because Africans did not own timepieces, they could not possibly take drugs that were dosed twice daily. Truth be told, I did not know quite what to expect. I was new on the job, off to a new country and continent, and with a newly formed organization, IAPAC. I was going at the invitation of another newly formed entity, UNAIDS, which had been launched only 1 year before. And to top matters off, our goal was to figure out how to introduce relatively new drugs in complicated regimens into a setting which had never seen them before. While the government of Uganda had already been grappling with this HIV epidemic for over a decade, this was still a time when news of the impact of HIV/AIDS in sub-Saharan Africa had not yet grabbed the world's attention. What we knew of the global pandemic was still largely in the form of cold statistics, almost unbelievable statistics regarding high infection rates, but still not attached to the sorts of pictures and experiences that have become more familiar to us over the past decade. There were no sleek and compelling documentary films, no high school or book club fundraisers, and no formal speeches such as this one. There were just the raw realities of a highly neglected and increasingly dire situation. The consequences are stark. Today, villages scattered across Africa are filled with AIDS orphans, 15 million of them according to UNAIDS, and a noticeable scarcity of an entire generation of adults who would otherwise contribute to socioeconomic stability and the security of nations. The origin of the situation we trace back to this time when the world continued to turn a completely blind eye to the African continent, or crippled it through debt and a plundering of its resources. By contrast, here in the United States in 1997, it was a time of great hope on the AIDS front. We were still reeling from the devastating losses of the 1980s, but by 1997, we were a few years into having not one, but multiple antiretroviral drugs that we combined into regimens were having a Lazarus-like effect on formerly bedridden men and women. The signs were promising, and many of us began to imagine what hope this portended not only here, but in countries such as Uganda, where HIV infection rates had climbed into double digits, in some cases taking grip of a quarter or more of a country's population. And so I landed at Entebbe International Airport, full of questions, fears, hopes, and uncertainty. Little could I imagine that what I discovered and experienced would shape me in ways I could scarcely have predicted. After checking into my hotel in Kampala, Uganda's capital city, I was welcomed by Dr. Peter Mujeni, a local collaborator on the UNAIDS Drug Access Initiative, an individual many of you may have seen seated next to First Lady Laura Bush during the State of the Union address in which former President George W. Bush announced his President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, or PEPFAR. More on that later. But back to 1997, when perhaps simply as a matter of course, or perhaps as a deliberate attempt to ground me in the realities of the situation, Dr. Mujeni invited me that afternoon to a funeral service for a patient of his who had recently succumbed to AIDS-related complications, mainly a combination of lethal and upper syncytial infections. It was an overcast day, and I distinctly recall the suffocating mixture of humidity and whirling red soil characteristic of the Kampala area as we made the half-hour drive from Kampala to Entebbe, the site of the funeral. As I learned en route, this was a weekly and sometimes daily ritual for Dr. Mugeni, attending AIDS-related funerals. It had been so since the early 1980s. And as he described the brief history of those early days in which the first individuals and subsequently families had begun to show signs and ultimately die of this illness they originally knew as Slim disease because of the weight its victims were shedding, I could not help but recall those days in the mid-1980s in San Francisco, New York City, Los Angeles, and other U.S. cities when quietly and under a veil of utter confusion and tragedy, our brothers and sisters, mostly gay men, were being stolen away from us in our country's AIDS wards. Here, too, a misnomer took the place of knowledge, science, and compassion. GRID, or gay-related immune deficiency, is how HIV was then known. But the situation had begun to change in the United States, as well as Canada, the United Kingdom, and much of Western Europe. HIV-positive men, women, and children were now living, not dying, due to the new antiretroviral drugs that had begun to arrive on the scene with AZT, the first of these wonder drugs, all which began to bolster immune systems by stemming HIV's fast-paced onslaught within otherwise healthy blood cells. These drugs meant increases in CD4 counts and reductions in the amount of HIV in patients' bloodstreams, thus leading to less likelihood of developing deadly opportunistic infections, and ultimately a lifting of the automatic death sentence an HIV diagnosis represented years before. These drugs also now meant that pregnant HIV-positive women were no longer condemned to passing on the virus to their children, a fate that is particularly cruel for both. This dichotomy struck me, and as we neared the funeral site, it began to set in: life and hope for some, death and despair for others. As we arrived in Entebbe to a gathering crowd of mourners, Dr. Mugeni greeted family and community members and introduced me simply as one of the Americans who had come, hoping to bring antiretroviral drugs and thus hope to a country decimated by endemic diseases as much as poverty. Half of the country's population lives below the international poverty line of $1.25 a day. Their faces bespoke a sort of thanks and reverence that immediately made me uneasy. I had neither assurances nor promises, nor drug commodities or other resources that could match their desperate sense of need and their fragile hope. As we stood to the side of the gathered friends, family, and community, a priest began to speak of the dearly departed son, father, husband, and friend, a man named Thomas. The ceremony proceeded, and as it did, Dr. Mugeni quietly translated for me the essence of what was being said, mainly in Luganda, the local language. The eulogy was peppered with a few words of English, accented by one particular word that struck me like a thunderbolt every time it was uttered. I did not expect to hear it, this word, since I had been under the impression that AIDS remained so highly stigmatized throughout the African continent, as it did elsewhere, that it was rare to utter even its name when talking about someone. But as I soon came to learn, AIDS had already taken such a devastating toll on virtually every family and community throughout Uganda that they had been forced to reckon with it, to at least give it name and voice, to acknowledge it, and to begin work to prevent it. Much of this was thanks to the national government, which had taken an early role, setting up the continent's first national HIV program in 1986. Still, as this English word, an acronym really, pounded out minute by minute, it clamored down on me under increasingly oppressive clouds. Each time it was uttered, the cloud seemed to press down further, heavier and heavier. AIDS. 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 Finally, the clouds broke, and with them, so too did our tears. Amidst the wails of Thomas's loved ones, I recall the rain pounding down upon us. Without an umbrella or cover, I remember being utterly soaked, a mess of water and tears, somehow feeling everywhere and nowhere at the same time, swept away in an inconsolable sense of grief for this man, his family, and his community, all of whom I had just met and knew only by name. I cried for the friends and the friends of friends who had faced a similar hopeless battle against AIDS in the United States before the advent of antiretroviral therapy. And I cried, for the very first time, but not the last, for the undignified, inhumane fact that as humans, we still allow the people of some countries to live with HIV, while we allow the people of other countries to perish. To this day, I still distinctly remember Thomas, a sunken face that nonetheless carried a smile in the last photo taken of him, one displayed at his funeral. I have since on occasion imagined and wondered who he actually was and what has become of his family. Another truth be told, I have rested content not actually investigating this any further. You see, I hold on to a delicate hope that somehow his children and family and friends have since escaped the tyranny of HIV that has somewhat subsided in Uganda, if not elsewhere on the African continent. This hope is often fragile, and I have learned that sometimes we must allow ourselves some of these self-defenses against what could be an utterly depressing, immobilizing sense of hopelessness. Since 1997, gradually, I've had to attend far fewer AIDS-related funerals. Thankfully, so too has the good doctor in Entebbe, since Uganda has become a model story of successful action within Africa. Here in the United States, it's now rare for individuals in need to go without HIV treatment, and even rarer to attend AIDS-related funerals. Here, HIV has become a chronic illness, not one that carries with it a definitive life sentence, although there are still major inconsistencies with the levels of care, types of drugs, and forms of support that are available from state to state, town to city, race to race, and gender to gender. And in sub-Saharan Africa, as well as other less affluent regions of the world, the numbers of individuals who benefit from global HIV treatment initiatives, including the before-mentioned PEPFAR, is steadily increasing, which has led to a 10% drop in the AIDS death toll over the last 5 years. However, we have still only scratched the surface, and every second another Thomas succumbs needlessly and preventively to HIV/AIDS. Globally, over 33.1 million people are now infected with HIV. 22 million of them, a full two-thirds, are in sub-Saharan Africa. High concentrations of HIV infection are also found in Latin America and the Caribbean, Southeast Asia, and large parts of Eastern Europe. This global figure of 33.1 million HIV-positive adults includes 2.1 million children under the age of 15, and has risen from 29.5 million in 2001. According to UNAIDS figures released today, the global epidemic is stabilizing, but at an unacceptably high level. Globally, there were an estimated 33.1 million people living with HIV/AIDS, as I mentioned, but the annual number of new infections also declined from 3 million in 2001 to 2.7 million in 2007. The rate of new infections, though, while it has fallen in several countries, has been offset by some increases that we've experienced both here in the United States and in Europe, for example, where the rate of newly infected doubled between 2000 and 2007. Without the necessary global commitments of energy and resources for HIV prevention, care, and treatment programs, if we were to backtrack today, as some have argued, we will easily resume a course where all of us on this planet will once again ride a population trajectory in which we are all imperiled by HIV/AIDS and the rapidly accelerating infection and death rates. While here in the United States we may be slightly more shielded from the sorts of high infection rates that exist in sub-Saharan Africa, Southeast Asia, and elsewhere, and therefore at marginally less risk, lessons from SARS, H1N1, and other infectious illnesses have taught us that these sorts of shields between populations and even across vast oceans are often paper thin. So too are the impacts on peace and political stability, as well as global commerce, all of which are deeply affected by the dynamic ebb and flow of the HIV pandemic. Now, I ask you to imagine for just a moment the threats to political stability, economic inputs and outputs, and global peace they may come to be if we allow nations of children to grow up without parents, or governments to spend all of their scarce resources paying off foreign debt or purchasing whatever high-priced antiretroviral drugs they can afford, thereby foregoing investments in their healthcare systems, in education, agriculture, infrastructure, and other keys to sustainable development. Who will plant and harvest the fields? Who will teach? Who will build? How will we avoid a descent into chaos and strife in a world filled with nothing but orphans and grandparents? I do not mean to sound alarmist, but at the same time, it is high time that we hear the alarm that has been sounding for years and years, unheard or maybe ignored. HIV/AIDS constitutes not only a grave humanitarian crisis, but also a shared political, economic, and national security crisis. As Americans, we cannot escape this reality, no matter how much we may wish to do so in these difficult economic times. Over the past few years, as a result of 9/11, the ongoing wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and the global challenges of terrorism, we have had our blinders removed as Americans. We now get the realities of global interdependence in a way that perhaps we did not just a few years ago. What happens over there, inevitably and often in unpredictable ways, affects us over here. It is high time that we all awaken to the very real threat that HIV/AIDS poses in this vein, and the necessity as Americans of adopting a reformed role as global citizens, if for no other reason than enlightened self-interest. So what is it that we have to do? Well, as the numbers that I spoke of earlier demonstrate, the challenge of arresting the global HIV pandemic is twofold: prevent new infections, on the one hand, and on the other hand, increase care and treatment for those living with HIV/AIDS. This is a difficult balance, not the least of reasons being the fact that still, the available resources worldwide do not come close to matching needs. As a result, there remains a constant tension between prevention and treatment. Some say that we must flood countries with money to prevent new infections, while others retort that we have a profound responsibility to actually provide care and treatment to those living with HIV, despite the cost. Both demand resources. These resource needs are particularly acute in the area of care and treatment, and there's no way around this. There's a need to purchase antiretroviral drugs, to build health system infrastructure, clinics, hospitals, medical equipment, and to train physicians, nurses, and community health workers, as well as other health professionals, who will be the advocates and guardians of change at the local level. Now, while all of this appears a Herculean task, I do not want to leave you with the impression that the odds are stacked against us. In fact, we have made tremendous progress in recent years. I want to leave you with a keen understanding that where individuals just like you have stood up and said, I can and I will make a difference, and we have supported our government's fuller participation in both global and domestic HIV/AIDS efforts, the rate of change and progress has been remarkable. I want to talk now about the United States for a moment before I return to the global HIV pandemic. Progress has been realized in the arena of domestic policy on many fronts here in the United States. Most recently, the lifting of the U.S. ban against HIV-infected visitors and immigrants into our country, a shameful policy that has been a blight on our national image in the world for decades now. That's just one example of our forward movement. Still, there remains much to be done here on the home front to prevent new infections and to provide more equitable care and treatment. HIV/AIDS continues to place in stark relief the all-too-common social inequities that plague our nation, including disproportionate impact on those who are marginalized within our society, the less affluent, those excluded due to sexual orientation, and particularly individuals and groups excluded due to race and ethnicity, most noticeably African American and Latinos, among whom the HIV infection rate is now of crisis proportions. Our effort to prevent new infections here requires commitment on our part to better gear prevention messages to diverse populations and to address the social and economic inequities that act as root causes of illness, such as HIV/AIDS. We must redouble our domestic efforts, but we must do things smarter and with greater inclusion of those who have heretofore been neglected. In the course of this work in the United States, one of the central challenges is for us to take a firm stand and declare out loud that harmful, ill-informed ideology must be banished from these efforts. It follows, for instance, that we must finally commit to lifting the federal ban on needle exchange funding in our country, a prevention measure which, with abundant evidence has demonstrated, is key to increased public health and safety. Preserving this ban is a result of punitive ideology and the willful exclusion of those coping with substance addictions, especially in the face of mountains of evidence demonstrating the success of needle exchange programs, is tantamount to premeditated murder. And it is not just in the arena of HIV prevention where we need to redouble our efforts. We also have important work to do in enhancing care and protections for those living with HIV/AIDS in our country. It is critical that within our ongoing push for meaningful health insurance and health care reform in America, we better safeguard the health and well-being of HIV-positive Americans. We can do this through a commitment to early access to HIV treatment, something which to this day is still not provided through Medicare or Medicaid due to restrictive eligibility definitions, but which is provided for within several health care reform bills currently before Congress. And systematically, we must work to make sure that we do not lose the expertise of HIV care providers as yesterday's and today's aging population of HIV specialists moves toward retirement. Ladies and gentlemen, we cannot and we must not rest on our laurels. Yes, we have come a long way since the dark ages of HIV/AIDS in our country, but 1.1 million HIV-positive Americans and those countless Americans at risk of HIV infection are counting on us to do more. Returning to the foreign policy front, the United States has also made important progress that provides signs of hope. A key example here is the Bush administration's creation of the U.S. President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, or PEPFAR, and the Obama administration's commitment to preserve or enhance these commitments through its own global health initiative. PEPFAR and the Global Health Initiative are examples of the potential for bipartisan commitment, even if there remain differences of approach and ideology, particularly regarding HIV prevention funding. PEPFAR was and remains a bold sign of hope for a brighter era of U.S. foreign policy. And the Obama administration's Global Health Initiative, which is now in development, is an extension of this era. But these are still small steps forward. The time has now come for America to embrace a more robust and a more constructive foreign development agenda, including a more nuanced and sophisticated fight against HIV/AIDS as a central pillar of that global effort. This pillar must include a commitment to universal access to HIV prevention, care, and treatment services throughout the world, and it must include support for evidence-based approaches to HIV prevention, including sexual health education, as well as family planning and condom distribution. We must walk away from approaches fueled by harmful ideology that squander our precious resources and needlessly condemn millions to disease and ultimately death. That said, AIDS funding must be one among many complementary pillars of our global health agenda. The United States must guard against the risk of sliding further down a road of what is known as AIDS exceptionalism, where the resources and energies of our development agencies are poured exclusively into HIV programming to the exclusion and often at the expense of other critical health care and health system needs abroad. AIDS funding, appropriated at levels equal to the burgeoning need, must be viewed as an opportunity and a gateway to also addressing malaria, tuberculosis, reproductive, maternal, newborn, and child health, nutrition, and neglected tropical diseases. And it must be leveraged to help build health systems and infrastructure abroad, resources that are not only necessary for effective HIV prevention, care, and treatment, but healthcare more generally. And perhaps most importantly, all of this must be packaged within a vision for America's place in the world, one in which we commit to eradicating global poverty, entrenching human rights, and working in partnership toward mutual benefit with the world community. Now, the Obama administration has a difficult choice of directions over the course of the coming months and years, one not made easier by naive pressures here in the United States to bury our heads in the sand and believe that somehow, if we exclusively deal with domestic pressures, we can return to an America of white picket fences and the unfettered American dream. That day and dream are gone, or rather they are gone to the extent that they can be achieved without meaningful, reciprocal, and mutually beneficial participation in a global compact to achieve human rights and sustainable development for all. And so the Obama administration and Congress will face the challenge of whether to persist along a path of American exceptionalism or whether we will adopt a reformed foreign policy agenda built on constructive engagement, peace building, and equitable global economic development. I would argue that such reforms and a renewed vision of America's constructive role in the world are the only way that we can stem the tide of HIV in far-off lands. But they are also ultimately the only way we can save ourselves from the inevitable doom signaled by the slow creep of HIV across the globe and its impact on the economic, political, and social relationships upon which American peace and prosperity are built and maintained. Much of the challenge we currently face in addressing the global HIV pandemic lies in the fact that it simply took us too long to get to work. Too many years were spent balking while millions and millions of people became infected and died of this disease. Still more time has been wasted throwing hands full of dollars at ideologically driven prevention programs, one which have done little to slow the speed of the pandemic's growth, while at the same time squandering our resources. We continue to live the suffering of this past inaction and waste today. Nevertheless, many governments and health organizations have persisted throughout, slowly building remarkable programs globally, month by month, year by year. Groups on the ground, both domestic and foreign, have established networks, protocols, and programs that we can seize upon to launch the next wave of efforts to prevent new infection and to better treat those living with HIV/AIDS. Treatments that were once the luxury of a privileged few here in the United States, Canada, Brazil, the United Kingdom, and Western Europe are now flowing to most parts of the globe, albeit not fast enough. Where once antiretroviral treatment was a dream in the developing world, now over 4.6 million people are estimated to be receiving life-saving care worldwide, 4 million of them in developing world countries. And each month, it's estimated that another 85,000 or so gain access. By contrast, just 5 years ago, fewer than 1 million people worldwide had access, and half of them were in wealthier nations. So in the course of just 5 years, we have more than quadrupled access to life-saving antiretroviral drugs, and we have made it slightly more equitable worldwide. But I return to the consequences of past inaction and their lessons for today. We are playing a desperate game of catch-up, and the surest way for us to fail and for all the world's citizens to ultimately succumb to the health, social, and political grip of the HIV pandemic is to rest contented with our recent marginal successes. antiretroviral drugs are not flowing quickly or broadly enough, nor do we have the cadres of physicians, nurses, and other healthcare providers, as well as clinics and hospitals that we need to translate access to drugs into effective ongoing care. I would ask those of you who are currently taking any form of medication, be it for high blood pressure, anxiety, or any other condition, to imagine what it would be like if you had a monthly supply of Lipitor, for example, but no access to the counsel and support of your physician, nurse, dietitian, or counselor. Drugs alone do not equal care or health, and this is doubly so in the case of HIV, which requires complex ongoing care and support. This is where the real and potential contributions of my own organization, IAPAC, are greatest, in enlisting the knowledge and expertise that is available to train the healthcare providers in HIV care and treatment, in making effective use of scarce health infrastructure, and in building national healthcare capacity worldwide. Yet, in our own work, we too feel the constant pressures of global demands and global needs, all of which far outstrip our current capacity. And so really, the potential to rescue those in desperate need worldwide, as well as ourselves from a future of shared death, despair, and instability, is to commit as Americans to a program of mutual global progress and equity. And by equity, yes, I mean a commitment to spending many of our scarce resources abroad, despite high need here at home. While this is a tough pill for many critics to swallow, I would suggest the consequences of not doing so will inevitably and ultimately be visited upon us in the future, and in ways I dare suggest we can now scarcely imagine. Our health, our economic, and our political stability hinge on our action or inaction. Are we capable, able, and willing to make this shift as Americans? I continue to believe that we are, and that we will further rise to the occasion. Coming back to that day in Uganda in 1997, you will recall that I confessed earlier to having never again visited Thomas's family to find out what has become of them, or a small community in Entebbe, even though I have now been back to Uganda several times. In crafting my remarks for this evening, I had the opportunity to reflect upon this and to acknowledge that this is a small defense mechanism that I have allowed myself over the past 12 years, perhaps mostly unconsciously. Those of you who have dealt with tragedies beyond your immediate control will appreciate how necessary such defenses become, and how coping and acceptance somehow become almost absurdly synonymous with selective forgetting or freezing our memories in time. But while I permit myself this all-too-human defense mechanism, I also accept that it comes with the responsibility of doing everything that I can to make sure that that experience, that my knowledge, and my energies are dedicated to reversing the sorts of ill fortune that claimed Thomas and continue to claim so many others. I would suggest that every one of us in this room tonight has his or her own Thomas, someone whom we knew perhaps closely or perhaps at the borders of familiarity, but who was taken from us not simply as a matter of natural course, but as a consequence of our collective failure to make this a more compassionate, dignified, and inclusive world. Your Thomas might have been in El Salvador or Bangladesh or right here in San Francisco. But what we rarely acknowledge is that these worlds of loss are so much closer together than the plain eye can see. We share not only this experience of loss, but the fact that these types of human loss are woven to a common thread and in similar patterns of social exclusion, injustice, and inequity. And so, just as I place the memory of Thomas in service of my decisions to foster inclusion and compassion and to help mobilize the efforts of IAPAC and our 13,000 members worldwide, so too would I humbly suggest that all of us here have the capacity and the responsibility to place the memories of our respective Thomases in service of creating a better world. I would encourage you to consider the fight against not only HIV/AIDS, but the conditions of debt, poverty, and inequity that engender in Sub-Saharan Africa and elsewhere, as one of the ways in which you can continue to make your own personal commitment to remember your Thomas and to act on his or her behalf. This may be through a donation to a relevant aid service organization, through a letter or call to your representatives in Congress or to President Obama, urging U.S. commitment to AIDS relief and progressive foreign policy, or it could be through your own local fundraiser, corporate support program, or a personal decision to challenge others in your midst when they suggest that we simply cannot do anything against such terrible odds, or we cannot afford to act during an economic recession. Perhaps it's all of the above, but I encourage you to act. Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel, a Holocaust survivor who marched and worked along Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. during the height of the Civil Rights Movement, reminded us that all it takes is one person, and another, and another, and another to start a movement. In my own lifetime, I hope that the forging of such a movement will mean that one day, no son or daughter, no wife or husband or partner, no mother or father, no friend will need to wail at the graveside of a loved one who has been taken away as a result of our inaction against HIV/AIDS and the condition that engendered its spread. Closing, as this movement continues to build and we recommit to bold action, I wish you courage, I wish you strength, and I thank you for helping make this a better world for us all.
You are listening to a program of the Commonwealth Club of California. Today's speaker is Dr. Jose Zuniga. We are commemorating World AIDS Day, December 1, 2009. Thank you, Jose, for that very moving talk and very personal talk. The question comes to mind when you said that the aging population of AIDS physicians in AIDS care is diminishing because of a function of time. What steps are being taken by medical schools all around the world or healthcare organizations such as the WHO to replenish the ranks of physicians providing AIDS care?
Thank you. Thank you again for the invitation to speak here today. The issue of health workforce shortages is a serious one. In Africa and other developing world regions of the world, we're losing physicians not just to age but also to disease. And it's an issue that is front and center as far as our association is concerned, since we represent those healthcare providers. But only recently has come to the forefront of the World Health Organization's work. We're working with them as well as with the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief and other institutions to try to identify ways of bolstering the production of new healthcare professionals. And here in the United States, looking at ways of incentivizing physicians and other healthcare providers to enter into HIV care, since in this country we do not have an HIV specialty, and a physician treating a person living with HIV/AIDS is reimbursed at the same rate as a physician who's treating someone with a cold.
So if a young person who is in medical school or thinking about going into medical school wanted to specialize in HIV/AIDS, what would be the route that she or he would take?
Currently, most HIV-treating physicians are infectious disease-trained and specialize in that area. In the future, we're hoping that we can gain ground as far as creating a subspecialty in HIV medicine, which would be a completely different career path.
You said some very interesting things during your talk, one of which was that perhaps there may be a squandering of funds too much on prevention programs. Did I hear that correctly?
On some prevention programs.
So if we are squandering funds on some prevention programs, there is an argument in the international community now that says that school of thought would lead to a rebalancing of healthcare portfolios so that HIV/AIDS does not suck up all the money that is in the healthcare budget, so that other diseases such as malaria, cholera, polio would get a proportionate share. What do you say to that?
Well, I think when I addressed the issue of HIV squandering money for HIV prevention, I meant the type of ideologically driven prevention programs that we witnessed over the last 8 years, which were abstinence-only based programs at the exclusion of condom distribution and other types of preventing HIV. I would never want to get into an argument of whether HIV receives too much money versus other disease processes, because in essence they all receive too little money. And the reality is that they've been ignored for so many years that the problems are even bigger than they should have been. But what's encouraging is that the Obama administration has launched what's called the Global Health Initiative that is meant to identify ways of leveraging what has been accomplished through PEPFAR, which is significant. This is the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, which has placed a tremendous number of people on treatment and prevented infections, especially mother-to-child transmission of HIV, to leverage that investment and see if we can use that as a pivot point to increase access to malaria care, malaria prophylaxis, tuberculosis care, care for neglected tropical diseases, which many of them are very inexpensive to treat.
So turning back to HIV prevention from a medical point of view, not from an ideological point of view, what is IAPAC doing in terms of education? There are new factors that have been identified, such as SEVI and others, that show us that the potency of the HIV virus can be multiplied sometimes 100,000 times if it's coupled or in the neighborhood of the right factor. Mm-hmm. So it seems like that sort of prevention program could actually go a long ways.
What we've done around prevention is to try and promote a prevention agenda that has been largely ignored over many years. It was sexier to address the issue of care because you could arrive at significant numbers of people you put on treatment. That represents success in some quarters, especially in the halls of Congress and at the White House. And so we've tried to position the argument so that it is prevention and care are interrelated in many respects, and especially now that we are looking at clinical trials that will, if successful, could allow someone to take a pill to prevent HIV or HIV infection, that's a significant step forward, and one that it could only be achieved by virtue of calling attention to the need for a balance between prevention and care.
You've mentioned PEPFAR many times about the efficacy of U.S. policy being engaged in a constructive way. So do countries that are on the U.S. Terrorist list, such as Sudan, for example, do they get AIDS relief money from the U.S. or from European allies?
Sudan is not one of the PEPFAR beneficiary countries. I can't speak to the State Department's portfolio for that country. I'm certain that there's some development and humanitarian assistance that's provided. The World Health Organization certainly has stepped into Sudan and other crisis-ravaged countries to provide general health care support.
Now, in sub-Saharan Africa, HIV-AIDS infection is one of a whole list of litany of societal ills, as it were, economic destabilization, lack of opportunity, lack of education, other health risks that are there. You mentioned a global or a holistic point of view for funding. If you were able to direct U.S. funding, what would be the number one area that you would direct funding to?
That's a tough one. It's difficult because all of these funding priorities on some level are interrelated. But in my mind, perhaps the bulk of the funding would go toward education, because it is such an incredible tool, not just to help pull people out of poverty and into productive jobs, but also has the ability to promote health education, reproductive education that is critical at this point, to stemming the tide of new HIV infections.
Well,
it creates, in our minds, a legacy for the types of funding that and programs that we're currently promoting in these countries. It creates sustainability at country level that's critical because we will not be in these countries for the rest of eternity. At some point, we will exit, and we need to leave something behind.
Well, let's talk about this for a minute. So you've mentioned that Uganda since the 1980s, 1986, I believe, has had a healthcare policy for HIV/AIDS. So and you also mentioned that there are over 15 million AIDS orphans throughout the world. I would imagine that in sub-Saharan Africa now, some of those orphans have survived now to adulthood. I mean, they're over age 21. What do we see from this population in terms of compliance with HIV prevention practices?
We're seeing very positive numbers coming out of Uganda and other countries where studies have been conducted among these very at-risk individuals. Having said that, it doesn't take very long for these trends to slip in another direction. And I'll cite one example. In South Africa, when President Thabo Mbeki was president of the country, some of you may recall that he denied or questioned, but he really denied it, whether HIV caused AIDS. He then spent the better part of a year having a debate with AIDS denialists and those of us who believe that HIV causes AIDS. I was included among the presidential panel that investigated the issue. And as much as it was political theater, it also had repercussions on the ground. I recall taking a cab from one medical center back to my hotel and being asked by the cab driver what I thought about President Thabo Mbeki's statement and how he felt that based on what he'd heard, he was convinced HIV didn't cause AIDS. So why should he use a condom? It's very easy for a political event, some type of issue to deter us from the successful road we're on. And I'll cite one example here, too, another example, and that is of Uganda, the country I've cited as a model for HIV-AIDS programming. As recently as last month, the Parliament of Uganda began to discuss passing a bill that would allow the government to incarcerate gays and lesbians in that country and to execute HIV-positive gay men who have sex with other men. So here we have a country that has been a paragon of success in dealing with this epidemic, but now is taking huge steps backward, which has huge implications for HIV prevention, because what would incentivize a gay man in Uganda or a man who has sex with men to even come to an HIV prevention conference or a meeting or go into the health system and say, I'm HIV positive, or can you test me? That becomes a huge barrier.
Speaking of ignorance, there are other global instances of ignorance, such as the president of Iran has said that Iran is free of AIDS and that no one in his country is infected. Do you have any data, or does your organization have any data about HIV/AIDS infections in Iran?
I know that the World Health Organization and UNAIDS have estimated a range for HIV infection in that country. I don't know what it is off the top of my head, but in the Middle East, it's relatively low infection rate for whatever reason. Still, there's progress that's been made. You know, for example, we worked with the government of Egypt many years ago as they started to admit that they had an HIV problem. We also had that issue in China, where for the longest time, China denied it had an HIV epidemic, and only recently has taken it on as a priority. They are now investing in antiretroviral drugs, they're investing in HIV prevention programs, and they're loosening some of their restrictions as far as how they take care of people who are at risk for HIV infection.
That sort of national change of policy is interesting, because you mentioned South Africa. South Africa has recently disclosed that a large number of its South African defense forces are actually HIV positive. They have active duty HIV positive identified soldiers, which are now peacekeepers throughout the continent of Africa. You mentioned China just now as changing its national policy. What do you attribute this change of policy?
I think China's change of heart came about largely because they wanted to join the community of nations. And as such, they had a need to address a human rights issue in a way that was bold and related leadership on the part of their Ministry of Health and of the president of that country. With respect to South Africa, I mean, I would point to, again, Uganda. The reason Uganda launched its HIV program in 1986, as it did, is that Yoweri Museveni, the current president of Uganda, overthrew Idi Amin in a military coup. He then sent his soldiers to train in France, worried that he himself might be the victim of a coup. They were tested for HIV, and a large percentage of them were HIV positive. So suddenly you had the president of a country who had just assumed power through a military coup, worried about whether he would retain power. He immediately started an HIV program. South Africa has only recently taken bolder steps toward addressing its HIV epidemic after years of denying that it had one and after years of a minister of health who absolutely refused to admit that antiretroviral therapy worked, instead promoting lemon juice and African potatoes as treatment. So we're seeing progress, and sometimes that progress is based entirely on enlightened self-interest.
Well, it seems like the progress is also based on data, where people are just surviving. With other infectious diseases, there seems to be also data that shows that if you throw money at it, there's also a high survival rate. Why should we separate out HIV funding from other infectious disease funding then?
I'm not sure we should separate it out. I think we should try and level the playing field. without hurting the great progress that we've made to date. For example, there are millions of people on antiretroviral therapy today as a result of PEPFAR. Antiretroviral therapy is a lifetime commitment. And so if we, for example, were to flat fund PEPFAR as it's currently flat funded for next year, in perpetuity, we would not see an increase in the number of people who would be on treatment. Treatment is also prevention. And so if we don't see increases in the numbers of people on treatment, we're going to see a creep up in the number of new HIV infections, which we want to avoid. You don't necessarily have that with other infectious diseases, or not as much. The other issue we're deeply concerned about is that of HIV that is resistant to multiple antiretroviral drugs. And it's an issue I didn't even address in my speech, but the reality that you could be infected with a strain of HIV that's already resistant to multiple antiretroviral drugs is a nightmare situation here and in Europe, where we have 8% or so of people who are infected with that type of virus. It would be a nightmare in the developing world.
Well, the antiretroviral drugs work on a specific mechanism during the HIV virus reproduction process. And there's basic research that's being done, some of it right here in San Francisco down the road at the Gladstone Institute, that talks about attacking it at various other points of its replication cycle. How does IAPAC interact with companies or organizations like the Gladstone Institute that are doing basic research or doing clinical research, and how does that, do those products translate into products that are used in Uganda or elsewhere around the world?
Well, absolutely. I mean, we're involved with various institutes, federal government, the NIH is an organization we work with quite a bit, whether it's on clinical research or behavioral interventions to promote adherence to therapy. This is a lifetime commitment that people make when they go on therapy to take any number of drugs per day for the rest of their lives. And so our mission is to help support our membership, which includes researchers, includes clinicians, includes nurses who are engaged on a research front. We also have corporate and other members of our association to whom we provide some level of consultant services, or we provide advisory services, for example, the pharmaceutical companies, around targets for each of these drugs, how to roll them out into developing world countries, pricing issues, trade issues, for example, intellectual property issues. So we deal with quite a number of different groups.
Well, that's an interesting thing that you talked about with pricing issues. The Clinton Global Initiative had a very well-publicized initiative where they got famously all of these pharmaceuticals companies in the U.S. and Europe to chip in, as it were, to make their drugs more affordable. What other examples in the private sector are there of partnerships or actually large-scale efforts to bring antiretroviral drugs or other treatments to other parts of the world?
There have been many initiatives that were launched at the outset of the introduction of antiretroviral therapy into Africa, for example. And this predates PEPFAR and the U.S. government engagement that we've seen over the last number of years. They were primarily sponsored by pharmaceutical companies that began to provide drugs at cost to countries. But what we found very quickly, and I think why we saw this engagement on the part of the U.S. government and eventually the creation of the Global Fund to Fight AIDS, Tuberculosis, and Malaria, is that at cost was still unaffordable for many of these countries. I mean, when you go to a country such as Uganda, where people live on $1.25 a day, to think that they'll be able to afford drug even at cost is absolutely ridiculous, and it just wasn't going to happen. So we saw a gradual increase in the numbers of people on treatment, but not at the scale that we've witnessed over the last 5 years, certainly.
Is there any truth to the rumor that drug companies from the U.S. are testing HIV vaccines or preventative drugs in Africa?
There are FDA and NIH-approved vaccine trials that are ongoing in Africa, but they go through the same rigorous types of scrutiny that a U.S. trial or a European trial would go through. And that also includes microbicides, so vaccines and microbicides.
So how effective is your office in Johannesburg in reaching the rest of South Africa, given the fact that South Africa itself is a nation that has a very turbulent history, but yet is such an economic powerhouse in Southern Africa, and the rest of the countries economically just don't match up to that? Is there resistance coming to South Africa, to Johannesburg, to deal with IAPAC, or is there... do you find that you have doors open to you because you're there?
We have found that because we are in South Africa and so many countries look to South Africa for guidance on HIV issues, that our presence is welcome. We have been in sub-Saharan Africa since 2000. We started out conducting trainings of HIV-treating physicians and nurses to manage common but lethal opportunistic infections. We then graduated into introduction of antiretroviral therapy. Our model, though, is not to bring people to South Africa, but for us to go out to the countries and to empower clinicians and nurses in those countries to conduct trainings, to build capacity, and to eventually advocate, because healthcare providers can be incredible advocates for care if you are able to harness their voices. And you know, one example is a nursing association that we helped in a very small sub-Saharan African country that had, before our intervention, served primarily as a union. So they rallied the nurses every time they felt there was a pay issue. That's important. But once the pay issue is resolved, there are any number of other issues that require dealing with, including the fact that nurses were dying at a disproportionate rate, that nurses were overworked, that they had one physician for the entire clinic, 300 patients to take care of. They didn't have supplies. They didn't have drugs. That requires professional associations, and that's where we've stepped in to help them create that environment.
How do you become culturally competent in your educational efforts across such a wide variety of cultures and histories, even in sub-Saharan Africa?
We have been very, very fortunate that our membership is extremely active. And so, you know, I mentioned Peter Mujeni earlier. He was a pioneer in Uganda as far as antiretroviral therapy was concerned. He was a great advisor to the Bush administration on PEPFAR, continues to be an advisor to the Obama administration. And I really think there are no better people than the people of these countries to create their own programs with our assistance and guidance where it's necessary to do good work. They're very resourceful in the way they do things, and it's just, I always come back from my visits to Africa feeling humbled and amazed by what they're able to do.
Are compliance rates directly correlative with governmental policies? For example, now that Uganda has this new policy, perhaps, of executing men who have sex with men, do you think that the compliance is now going to plummet for people who are on antiretroviral therapies?
I think that there will be an adverse effect on not just adherence to therapy, but prevention efforts, testing efforts, because it's become a witch hunt. As recently as 6 months ago, there was a front page article in one of the Ugandan dailies that had photos of 25 men allegedly gay. No backup whatsoever, just name, address, and some hearsay about this person being a homosexual and or HIV positive. That tends to drive the epidemic underground. And when that happens, we see explosions in the numbers of new HIV infections and in deaths.
Where is HIV growing in the world?
It's growing in the former Soviet bloc as a result of injection drug use and tuberculosis co-infection. It's growing in some parts of Southeast Asia. It's growing right outside our back door here in Haiti, where we have an uncontrolled epidemic, and shameful in many respects. And it's growing here in the U.S. I mentioned Europe in my speech, but here in the U.S. too. Washington, D.C., for example, has the highest prevalence of HIV infection in the nation now. That's an estimate. Some say it's closer to 5%. It's appalling to think that in our nation's capital, we have that level of HIV level of HIV infection. Having said that, it again points to the social inequities that drive that type of epidemic. New Orleans and Baton Rouge happen to be number two and number three on that list.
You mentioned the social economic impact of HIV/AIDS. The impact on women is much. The impact of HIV/AIDS is much greater on women than it is on men globally. Certainly, what do you see has been a very effective woman-targeted campaign that helps either with compliance or prevention with HIV/AIDS?
There are thankfully quite a number of organizations that are specifically created to address the issue of women and HIV, whether it's from the perspective of negotiating sexual rights, the reality that many women do not in sub-Saharan Africa and Southeast Asia and other parts of the world, Latin America, do not have the ability to negotiate reproductive rights is a huge issue that requires and is being addressed, but requires much more attention. But so too, the inequities that exist in who can access care. In some countries, men receive care before women. This is a rationing of health care based on what society deems as who brings the bread to the table and who contributes most to society.
We call those death squads in America.
These are certainly issues that require addressing, and you're right. Women are disproportionately affected as a result of these terrible challenges, not to mention the whole issue of mother-to-child transmission of HIV, which when you don't afford a woman the right to protect her child and herself, and I stress herself too, because too many programs early on focused only on the child and then left the mother to die of HIV-related complications. So a program that both addresses prevention of mother-child transmission and the health of the mother are absolutely critical.
So I know that you flew here specifically from your IAPAC conference in New Orleans. So what is the hot topic at your conference right now with the physicians treating AIDS?
It is trying to, on the global front, ensure that people living with HIV/AIDS in Africa and other parts of the developing world benefit from second and third line regimens. It's a little known fact that at present, most of the programs that I've talked about only afford access to first-line therapy, meaning the first regimen you receive as after diagnosis and if you're clinically eligible for treatment. Most patients burn through that first regimen pretty quickly if they don't adhere to the regimen. 90% or higher adherence is required to achieve treatment success. And so unless we're able to secure access to those second and third-line regimens at prices that the developing world can afford, we will have extended the lives of people for 2, 3, 4, 5 years and then condemned them to death again. That was a big topic of conversation on the international front. On the domestic front, it was dealing with the fact that we now have an aging population of HIV-positive people who are dying of heart attacks, liver disease, and other diseases we would never have imagined HIV-positive people in this country would ever have experienced, given the fact that life expectancy was so low. So now we have to contend with the dynamic of an older population of HIV-positive people with their health needs, just a challenge, because most HIV specialists are not cardiac specialists or liver specialists.
So we've come now to our very last question for the evening, which is, now that HIV/AIDS is seen to be a chronic condition here in the United States, are we, in fact, in a world where there are people who will definitely live, even though they are HIV positive for decades, and then there are people who will basically die because HIV is a death sentence for them in their country?
Yes. Yes, unfortunately, yes. But, I mean, that's where we need to redouble our efforts to make sure that the benefits of science and medicine are afforded universally to people. I mean, it's part of the debate we've been having here in the United States around healthcare reform, but it's really a more global debate that should be going on, especially as we recognize that an epidemic in Africa is an epidemic in the United States.
Thank you, Dr. Jose Zuniga. We have been marking World AIDS Day here at the Commonwealth Club of California. And now the Commonwealth Club meeting for tonight is adjourned. You're welcome to stay and talk with Jose.